This is the EWN Radio Network.
Hi, and welcome to Empowering Motherhood Radio. This is Tara Darlington. I'm here to shine the light for your journey in motherhood. There's so much conflicting information around, and it's nice to have a detailed discussion on certain issues. And today we're absolutely happy to have Sarah Buckley here, Dr. Sarah Buckley, who is a GP and a home birther and a big advocate of bringing normal into birth. It's very much seen as a medical event and something that needs to be fixed. But there is a whole other road that you can take with your pregnancy, with your birth, and with your early parenting that is all about you listening to yourself and listening to your body. And there's a lot of trust that we need to regain in our bodies as women, and connecting with that instinctive nature that we have around, especially around pregnancy and birth. So welcome to the show, Sarah. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Tara. Thank you for that beautiful introduction too. I could have said the same thing myself. It's just, yeah, that's exactly what I talk about, is really the what I call the superb, Mother Nature's superb design, how superbly designed our female bodies are for labour and birth, for early mothering as well, and how, you know, how we can align ourselves and get more ease, pleasure and safety actually by aligning ourselves with Mother Nature's superb design.
Yeah, that's right. And there, when you say ease, there's so much anxiety around. Women are just living with so much anxiety around pregnancy and birth and early parenting, and just the conversation around it being so difficult and hard and unmeasurable. So many women are experiencing that. Just to get started, you know, where have we gone wrong a little bit that so many women are, having a negative experience of pregnancy, birth and early parenting?
Well, I think there's two ways to answer that question, Tara. I mean, certainly we have a whole cultural belief around pregnancy and birth, that it's dangerous, that our bodies are set to fail. You know, there's so much language around that, you know, failed vaginal birth, failed home birth, you know, incompetent cervix. I mean, there's a lot of language that really reinforces that idea that our female bodies don't work so well. And, you know, when I look at the hormonal physiology behind that, you know, when we become fearful, when we add fear into the mixture, that can actually impede the function of our female bodies and labour and birth. And one of the analogies I use, and it's a really great analogy, because when we look at the hormonal physiology and the way that our hormones work in labour and birth, we can see that making a baby is actually almost exactly the same hormonal physiology as having a baby. So that, you know, when imagine taking that sort of anxiety and that fear that your body isn't going to work into making a baby, and you know, you can see how that will interrupt things. So when we take that anxiety into having a baby, it can really, you know, cause problems with our hormonal flow. And not just that, but again, looking at that analogy, if we take the sort of disturbances that we put into labour and birth, you know, often you turn up in a place that's not familiar to you, you have people you don't know looking after you, you may or may not have familiar people caring for you, like your own partner or a doula, your own midwife, those things that don't come as part of the package of modern maternity care. And all of those things shift the functioning of that primitive part of the brain, the limbic system, exactly as the circumstances would do if we were trying to make a baby in those circumstances. So, you know, what I say in my work is that the core requirements for birth in all mammals is that the labouring female feels private, safe and unobserved. Some of we don't feel private, safe and unobserved. And again, sometimes I talk about, you know, anthropological, our history, you know, humans not so long ago, more than 10,000 years ago, giving birth in the wild, where these things like having a hormonal system that ensures that we're in the safest place possible was really important. So we have these, you know, when you're in labour, if listeners have actually been in labour themselves, you might recall this, that you're in this, you know, in this sort of state where you're actually quite alert to your surroundings. And that's, you know, from these millions of years of evolution of giving birth in the wild. So if we don't feel private, safe and unobserved in our birthing, you know, that's a dangerous position to be in the wild. And it causes that the release of our fight or flight hormones, and it can basically stop labour, just as the sort of circumstances would stop, you know, making a baby would stop sexual activity. It's really the same orchestration. So yeah, there's a cultural aspect that make, you know, a belief that birth is painful and dangerous, and then there's how that impacts our physiology, and then there's how we actually treat labouring women and the circumstances that we provide that can really interfere with our hormonal flow in labour and birth.
Yeah, well, we had it interesting. I've got six children. I had the last four at home, and with my fifth one, my cat was pregnant at the same time. And we had quite an interesting, 3 days after I had my baby, we heard little peep, peep, peep in the hallway cupboard, and opened the door to see, oh, you know, we thought, oh, she's had her babies, and there was a little pile of wet kittens there. She was sort of sitting next to it, because by opening the door, what we realised afterwards was that we had interrupted her in the middle of labour, and she'd stopped to check that everyone was okay and that it was safe to continue and to guard her babies, and then we shut the door and she had two more kittens.
That's exactly right. And in my workshops and in my DVD, actually, my Understood Birth DVD, I tell stories about how other mammals give birth. And it's very interesting because cats tend to be solitary birthers, like exactly as you've described. But some animals actually like to have other members of their social group with them. So elephants, apparently giving birth in the wild, is surrounded by a group of female helpers who sway in time with the labouring female, and they soothe her with their trunks. And, of course, they form a formidable barrier from any predators. So, you know, giving birth in the wild with a circle of elephants around you is quite a good setup. And, you know, there's some stories of elephants giving birth in a zoo where they don't have that support, and it's much harder for them. And labour is quite disruptive and quite abnormal. There's a story of an elephant in labour all day and not giving birth until the following day, because she didn't have those female helpers around her. And I say that women we're a bit like animals. Like, some of us want to go into a cupboard like your cat and give birth with no one there. And some of them like a whole circle of elephants around us, and some like one person with us, like a dolphin, has a dolphin midwife. And some of us like the father there, like an orangutan birth story that I tell. So, you know, it's really, there's no rules, I think, in labour and birth, and you probably know this from having six children, but it's really what feels right to you at the time. You know, how do you feel private, safe and unobserved in those circumstances? So, you know, one of the things that I say to women is, you know, set yourself up a situation where there's a lot of flexibility, where you can have people there, or you can tell them to go away, or you can be in a cupboard or in a small bathroom giving birth, and that's quite typical for first babies. You really do need that sense of privacy, because these hormones are doing something they've never done before. Your body's doing something it's never done before. And the whole thing, in fact, from a hormonal perspective, is much slower to take off. Sometimes I describe birth being like a snowball. It starts off small and gets bigger and bigger and bigger as it goes downhill and becomes virtually unstoppable. And in the beginning, with that snowball gaining momentum, it can be easily put off. And, you know, that's what happened to your cat. And it not infrequently happens if a woman's labouring well at home and then she transfers to hospital, and suddenly, you know, she might have like an intellectual idea that this is a safe place to give birth, but, you know, from her sort of primitive brain, the limbic system says this is not safe, this is unfamiliar, there's strange people, strange smells, strange noises. And, you know, it often shuts off labour and it doesn't start again until you sort of settle in and feel safe and maybe have some familiar things with you, some familiar people. So that that sense for ourselves of being private, safe and unobserved is quite individual and quite circumstantial. But really important to think, you know, if you are setting up this situation to give birth, you could use the analogy I just mentioned and think, would this be a good place to make a baby? Because if it is, then it's got to be the right circumstances to have a baby.
Yeah, that's right. And the whole hospital setup is sort of counterintuitive to birth in a lot of ways, isn't it? So immediately on arriving in hospital, you often are observed and interrupted, and all of those, your privacy is, you know, no longer there. And as you said, there's that real resettling time in, which everybody really acknowledges. It's often like, okay, I'll leave you alone to settle back in. You know, so what are the sort of things that women need to do there? You know, if they are moving to hospital, they really need to be proactive about creating that space once they arrive, don't they, with meditation or, like you said, having your own things there. What sort of things do women need to do when they, you know, to bring themselves into that space?
Well, there's two different ways I could answer that question, Tara. And in fact, I do a great part of my workshops where we talk with childbirth professionals like midwives, doulas, childbirth educators, and I get some great hints from them about how can you help women to be undisturbed in their labour. And some of the things that they suggest is really trying to make the space as private as possible. So, hang a sign on the door, not before entering. And ideally, really have someone with you that can help to maintain the privacy of that space. So your own doula, your own midwife, for example. Talking about the primitive brain and the limbic system, I talked about how that's really tuned into smells and noises and things like that. So again, you want to reduce stimulation, so you want to have like familiar smells, and one of the ones I loved, actually someone said bring a pillow in and you can bury your face into that pillow and cut off your own pillow, it's got your own smell in it, you can cut off external stimulation as well, so that's a great one. But the other, so you're taking things in, that whatever it is, the smells, the things you can look at that are going to make you feel as homely or as comfortable as possible in that circumstance. But I want to add something else which is really important. We talked about labour being like a snowball, so it starts off small and gets bigger and bigger, and by the time it gets towards the end of labour, it's virtually unstoppable. So if a woman delays going into hospital until her labour is virtually unstoppable at that stage, it's the hormones, those fight or flight hormones that we talked about, are much less likely to railroad, to put, to throw out her hormones. And in fact, in some circumstances, a little bit of stress at the end of labour can actually promote labour. And it's an adaptation to giving birth in the wild, where I call it the saber-toothed tiger effect. So if you imagine, your great-great-great 500 great-grandmother giving birth in the wild and the saber-toothed tiger turns up early in labour, obviously the safest thing is for her to slow or stop her labour, to gather herself up and run away and find a safe place. So, those fight-or-flight hormones will slow down or stop labour in the early stages. But if the saber-toothed tiger turns up and she's really close to that time of having a baby, labour is that huge snowball and virtually unstoppable. It makes much more sense for her to give birth to her baby quickly and grab her baby, scoop her baby up and run away. And that can be what happens at the end of labour, like a surge of these hormones can be part of the natural process that actually accelerates the progress of labour. But the take-home message from this is really that if you can have someone that can be at home with you, your own doula, your own midwife, someone who's experienced, that can give you the confidence to stay home until labour is at that unstoppable time, then transferring to hospital is much less likely to interfere with the hormonal processes. And again, from our workshops, one of the midwives said to me, I know it's time to take for a woman to go into hospital when she can't remember her phone number. So that's really...
Yeah, right.
We get, we get deep into that limbic system, our sort of functioning, our intellectual brain shuts down, and we're just in that whole hormonal experience. Some people say, let your monkey do it, and it really is a very primitive functioning, you could say, that has us give birth. Again, it's like making love, it's like making a baby. But that time when you're close to the end is when you can't, you're not going to think of a shopping list or your phone number. And it's really, as I said, a very similar sort of orchestration of our hormones, you could say.
Yeah, and there's a real, I know for me with my first one was a hospital birth at the birth centre, and I had a very strong instinct when it was time for me, where I wanted to be, where I was going to have the baby. And also with my home birth, again, my thing was always, I'm the cat birthing on my own. I'm going to my bedroom and I don't want anyone to come, and the door shuts and I know they're thinking, oh, she's going to have the baby soon. But again, I had a very strong urge to be where I was wanting to have the baby. And that went, the more we allow this uninterrupted labour, then the more hormones we get, don't we? And so we do become a lot more instinctive about what we need in labour.
I think that's right, Tara. And the hormones work optimally because they're not being interfered with by those fight or flight hormones. Well, in fact, a lot of the information I'm giving you here is abstracted from a report that I wrote. It's a slightly technical report, or I could say a very technical report. It was published in January through Childbirth Connection in the US, which is a program of the National Partnership for Women and Families. And my report's called Hormonal Physiology of Childbearing. And it's mainly aimed at birth professionals, but if you're an interested parent as well, you could get a lot of information out of it. It's available free as a free PDF download. It's quite technical, but there's some really great information in there, and particularly the section in there about stress in labour and birth and how to, you know, how that can impact. Because what we know when we start to dig a bit deeper is there's a lot of mechanisms by which stress can railroad or can reduce the functioning of the birth hormone. There's many different stress pathways that contribute to that, which really tells us, you know, the way that our bodies work. You know, we're really meant to be hyper-responsive to stress and hyper-responsive to disturbance in labour, and it comes back to exactly what you say. The less disturbed we can be in labour and birth, the more likely things are to flow in their own time and to go more quickly, more effectively or efficiently.
Yeah, that's right. And with that, so now I want to come on to that point of, you know, the safer labour. So, you know, the more we can support our body into a more straightforward labour and birth, then the safer we're looking at things being. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, that link between supporting a woman into normal labour and a safer labour.
Well, the first thing to say is that those fight or flight hormones that I just spoke about, one of the effects they have is to slow down or stop labour. They have a direct effect on the muscle of the uterus. They slow it down and they probably reduce the effectiveness or maybe even the release of oxytocin, which is a major hormone that causes the contractions in labour. But the other thing that these hormones do, and this is really a short-term survival strategy we're talking about, again, if we go back to the wild, the saber-toothed tiger turns up, what you get with a surge of these hormones is you get the blood directed to the parts of the body we need for fight or flight, which is our lungs, our heart, our major muscle groups, but the blood has to come from somewhere. So the blood is actually taken away from the uterus and baby and a labouring woman if she has a fight or flight response. And as I said, the strategy is a short-term survival. So the mother later stops, the mother has everything she needs for fight or flight. She runs away, she finds a safe place. Stress hormone levels go down and then the blood flow can return to the baby. So when a woman's in this fight or flight situation because she's not feeling private, safe and unobserved, then we know that that can impact the blood supply to the baby. It's kind of hard to do this in human research, but there's a lot of animal research. Again, I refer you back to my report that shows exactly what happens to the baby's blood supply when the mother gets a surge of these fight or flight hormones. So just the fact of the woman feeling private, safe and unobserved from a physiological perspective is going to make it safer for her baby. And the other advantage of going with the hormones and really optimising the hormonal physiology is that it reduces the need for other interventions. And you've talked about birth centres and home birth. I mean, those models of care, having your own midwife, having a doula as well, if you go into a hospital, all those things reduce your chance of having interventions. And the problem with these interventions is that they interfere with the hormonal physiology. So, for example, synthetic oxytocin can interfere with our own oxytocin systems that can shift the receptors, so our own oxytocin doesn't work so effectively. And of course, synthetic oxytocin, Pitocin in the US, also called Syntocin in other countries, causes longer, stronger, and closer together contractions than our own oxytocin, our own natural release does. And that can cause stress for the baby. You know, the baby, in a natural labour and birth, the baby is going to be deprived of blood and oxygen to some extent when the mother's uterus contracts. But there's all these safety mechanisms that can help the baby to survive that. And there's hormonal mechanisms, including the release of beta endorphins for the baby, which protects the brain. These fight or flight hormones are actually released in the baby in labour, and they protect the brain. They're neuroprotective. They protect the brain cells from low oxygen levels. They also maintain blood supply to the brain. Oxytocin in animal studies, we don't know in humans, but probably the same thing, also has a neuroprotective effect. So there's all these natural protective mechanisms in the mammalian birth because, of course, we're all here, we're all mammals, we've all survived because of these protective factors in labour. So the natural protective factors can also get interfered with by various interventions. For example, that the fight or flight hormones, that has been called the catecholamine surge, that happens in late labour for the baby that gives that neuroprotection. Of course, if the baby is born by a pre-labour cesarean, the baby doesn't get that catecholamine surge and doesn't get those protective factors to help it. If the baby, for example, if the baby is exposed to synthetic oxytocin, those longer, stronger, close together contractions, the baby's not going to get that the same protection from the catecholamine surge. So, you know, physiologic undisturbed birth not only optimises the flow of the mother's hormones and reduces the stress hormones, which protects the baby, but it also reduces the chance of interventions and labour and birth that can stress the baby. And one take-home message to anyone listening to this program is that, you know, if you're offered an intervention, and that intervention involves monitoring your baby, continuous monitoring, then you know there's a risk to your baby. So interventions such as synthetic oxytocin, such as epidurals, do involve risk to the baby and do require monitoring. A normal physiologic undisturbed birth, there's all these safety mechanisms, so that doesn't require continual monitoring. In fact, continual monitoring is harmful in that circumstances, increases the risk of interventions without any benefits for mothers and babies.
Yeah, there's a lot of that fear, and you know, plays a role in everything as well, doesn't it? It starts long before you're in labour. You know, so much negativity in the media, and you know, we're sort of bombarded with stories of fear and negativity, and we're not as bombarded with the, you know, real stories from women who are having, you know, have had really, you know, beautiful births and have, you know, experienced this sort of birth that you're talking about. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I, you know, trained as a birth educator and doula. I just wanted to be another voice out there, you know, and another person telling their story, really. And so, you know, yeah, there's a lot of misinformation in the media, or perhaps one side, you know, one side of the story has just been, you know, overweighted. So, you know, that fear and that sort of flight and fight can even begin before you even go into labour, can't it?
It certainly can, and I think, you know, what you're saying is very true, unfortunately, and one of the things that contributes to that is the numbers. There just aren't many women having this physiologic experience of birth that is so ecstatic and fulfilling. I mean, in my work, not so much in the report, but if you go to my website, sarahbuckley.com, you can sign up to my newsletter as a parent or as a professional and download a free ebook. And I'd recommend a professional ebook called Ecstatic Birth, Nature's Hormonal Blueprint for Labour, because these hormones that we're talking about are hormones of ecstasy. We're talking about oxytocin, which is a hormone of love. It's an ultimate feel-good hormone. It's a hormone of attachment, calm, connection. We're talking about beta endorphins, which are reward hormones, and they can feel pleasure. We're talking about adrenaline, noradrenaline, which are excitement hormones, and we're talking about prolactin, which is, again, a calming, soothing, mothering hormone. So all of these hormones peak in just at the moment of birth and for the hour afterwards, and they imprint pleasure and reward and even ecstasy for the mother with her new baby. And the ecstasy depends really on the full expression, the optimization of the release of these hormones in labour and birth. So when so many women are having these interventions like pre-labour cesarean, where you don't even get off the ground with the hormones, epidurals interfere with all of the hormones we're talking about to some extent. Synthetic oxytocin, as I said, can interfere with some of those systems. As far as we know, there's not a lot of research on that. But, you know, when we start to interfere with those hormones, are we actually making birth less pleasurable, less rewarding for mother and baby? And the concern I have is even beyond that, because, you know, what I believe happens from the research, and again, you can read it in my report, is that during that hour after birth, from the peaks of labour and of hormones of labour and birth and the contact with her baby, the mother's reward centres are actually what I call imprinted. So there's a permanent change that she finds her baby rewarding, not just at the time, it's not just a good feeling right there and then, but it's designed to imprint reward in relation to contact with her baby. And this makes sense if you think about other animals. You know, other animals don't go to, you know, prenatal classes, don't learn how to be a mother. It's got to kick in straight away after birth. And one of those aspects of attachment is that the mother's rewarded and motivated to give this dedicated care to the baby. So if I could share some animal examples. For example, in mice, if you present a pregnant mouse with a baby, she'll actually, sorry if you're pregnant to tell you this, but she'll actually cannibalize the baby. Whereas after labour and birth, with all those peaks of hormones, she'll take dedicated care of a baby at that time. And other animals, it's similar. And you know, we can say, well, we're women, we're not animals, we can bond with babies that we don't even give birth to, and that's true. We can certainly form strong relationships, strong attachments with children that we adopt, children that we haven't given birth to, children born by cesarean. I'm not saying there's any problem with that, but there is this aspect that I call in their report biological bonding that's designed to switch from those centres that the mother continues to find her baby rewarding and motivated. And goodness me, you know, motherhood's a big job. It's a long path. And the more biological help we get, the more pleasurable it is. I think that's a really great head start. So they did do some human research in this. So they got women 2 to 4 weeks after giving birth, either by pre-labour cesarean, so no hormonal flow at all, or by a fairly physiological birth and a major intervention. And they actually put them into an MRI machine, magnetic resonance imaging machine, which can look at the activation of their brain. And they played them the sound of their baby crying. And what they found was when women had been through this physiologic experience of birth that we're describing, but actually the reward centres of their brain lit up in response to their baby crying. The reward centres, the empathy centres, the alertness centres. And that didn't happen to the same extent for the mothers who had given birth by pre-labour cesarean. So again, I'm not saying you can't be a great mother, you can't enjoy your baby if you've given birth by pre-labour cesarean, but there's this agenda that Mother Nature has to increase the reward, increase the pleasure, make your interactions with your baby rewarding and pleasurable ongoingly from those hormone peaks of labour and birth. And just one more thing to say was that if you miss those hormone peaks of labour and birth, because sometimes there are good reasons to have a pre-labour cesarean, to have various interventions, then every time that you breastfeed and every time you have skin-to-skin contact with your baby, those hormone systems are activated to some extent. It's hard to get those peaks of labour and birth, you know, that's within those few hours of giving birth, all those systems are activated. And if we use the lower levels of those hormones from skin-to-skin contact from breastfeeding, it's a much slower process, it takes longer, but we can still get reinforced those attachment systems that give us pleasure in relation to contact with our babies.
Yeah, that's right. I did have a set Caesar with my second one. I had placenta previa, and you know, knowing this, I really went out of my way. I mean, he's 11 now, to have, you know, constant skin-to-skin, really. I've barely put him down. You know, and I've noticed over the last few years that the skin-to-skin with the mother and the baby immediately after cesarean, you know, there's a lot more effort to allow that than there was 10 or 11 years ago. And that's, you know, because that there is that attachment, it is because of the hormonal process, and it is needed. And we have to look at the amount of postnatal depression that we have, and, you know, the rising interventions in labour and, you know, the correlation between the two.
Well, that's right. A couple of things to say about that. So in the report and in my work as well, we're not saying that physiologic childbirth is one end of the spectrum and, you know, intervention is the other end and you've got to be one side or the other. What we're saying is, you know, if you do need interventions, how can we add more hormonal physiology? And what you're describing, which is skin-to-skin contact as soon as possible after the cesarean and ongoing, is the optimal way to introduce more physiology, to get those hormones going between mother and baby, to switch on actually the baby's innate breastfeeding program through skin-to-skin contact. So it's a very, very important and very welcome development that we're doing that for mothers and babies after cesarean. So that's really important. I'll just share a story. It really fits in with what you just said. And it was actually a story I read in the magazine. It was a mother who had several physiologic births with all of our hormones previously, and the third baby was born by pre-labour cesarean, which was necessary for medical reasons like yours. And she said her instinct was to cuddle her baby, to have her baby on her skin to skin all the time. And she said, when my cesarean baby came out, the baby felt really different to my other babies. And that's really reflecting that these hormones impact the baby as well. The baby's designed to be in this alert, quiet, calm, connected state after birth. And obviously this pre-labour cesarean baby doesn't have that experience. And she said, after 3 days of skin-to-skin contact, my baby felt like my other babies. And it's really a great illustration of exactly what I was saying, that these hormonal processes are very efficient and effective. So those few hours of labour and birth, or even few days of labour and birth, switch on all of the systems for mothers and babies, put the baby into this ideal hormonal state to meet the mother, to begin breastfeeding, to form this attachment bond with the mother. But if that's missed, it takes longer, you know, 3 days of constant skin-to-skin to get the baby and the mother to that same situation. So, you know, labour and birth are designed to be very, you know, very effective and efficient use of resources as well.
Yeah, I definitely had that experience of it taking longer and just not feeling, I remember my first thought was, it doesn't feel like my baby. I think I said it out loud, actually. but I was grateful because I knew that that what I needed was the skin to skin, and it is good to see that being encouraged more, you know, more and more. So the other question I have, like with the, you know, there's the pre-labor or the elective cesarean, I guess it's also referred to, and then going into labor and then having a cesarean. So if people are having an elective cesarean for a medical reason, you know, are there advantages of allowing labour to start and then having a cesarean?
Well, look, don't really have research on that, and I guess one of the reasons is because it's a lot more disruptive to hospital routines rather than scheduling everyone to come and have their pre-labour cesarean in the morning and doing like 10 at a time, whatever. You know, to actually wait for women to go into labour is, you know, it probably requires more resources, so we haven't done studies on that. But if we take a step back and look at the physiology, then I would say that is the ideal type of cesarean, because it's exactly what you were saying. It's those pre-labour preparations that mother and baby make that optimise all of that hormonal flow. We've only talked about the hormones so far, but hormones are just one part of the whole hormonal system. And other parts of the hormonal system include these things we call receptors. And when I do my talks on this, I do some hand movements, so I'll have to explain without the hand movements. So basically, a hormone is a substance that's made in one part of the body and has effects in another part of the body. And the way that has effects is it binds to a specific hormone receptor. It's a bit like when you put a key, specific key into a specific lock, that turns the key, and that produces an effect inside the cell, because these receptors are on the outside. Most of the receptors are on the outside of the cell. So oxytocin, we talk about oxytocin, which is this major hormone that causes the contractions of labour. It's released from the brain, goes through the bloodstream to the mother's uterus, binds with the receptors in her uterus, turns the key, if you like, and that sends a message into the cell saying contract. So that's how oxytocin from the mother's brain causes uterine contractions. But all the hormones work in that way. So what happens before the physiologic onset of labour, the natural onset of labour, is all these hormone systems get activated, get upregulated. We call it in scientific sense. So the oxytocin receptors are increased. And we know that that's true in women. We've done studies of that in women. So that at that moment of the physiologic onset of labour, her uterus is sensitive and to oxytocin as possible. So just a little bit, you know, just her own release of oxytocin will get everything going. And that's only the oxytocin system we're talking about. There's many other systems involved in the physiologic onset of labour, which is chapter 2 in my report if you want to read that. So we know that's true in women with oxytocin receptors in the uterus. We know from other animal studies that we can't do in women at this point, is that the receptors to these hormones in the brain and the breasts are also increased in the lead up to labour, so that the breasts are ready for lactation, so that the brain is ready to switch on all these attachment systems that we're talking about, and so that for example, the natural or endogenous pain relief systems, the analgesic systems, are also maximally activated in the lead up to labour. So all these pre-labour physiologic preparations help the baby, help the mother to deal with the stress and pain of labour, help the baby. That we talked about the catecholamine surge, those fight or flight hormones that help to protect the baby in labour. They also optimise the transition to life outside the womb. So they also start to clear the lungs of fluid, they open up the airways, they increase the lung lubricant, which is called surfactant. So all of these ways that this release of these catecholamines in labour prepares the baby for life outside the womb. So they're an incredible transition. If you think about it, babies never breathe, and suddenly after birth the baby has to breathe. It's incredible that it happens, you know. But all these things are the baby's catecholamine system, the receptors for those in the baby's heart and brain and lungs in particular are also activated or upregulated before the onset of labour. So what that means is that at the physiologic onset of labour, when the baby, as far as we know, it's the baby that sends a signal to the mother, and then the mother's body gets ready for the onset of labour. There's all these signals passing between mother and baby. So as far as we know, it's the baby that initiates labour, but we don't fully understand those processes. I'd get a Nobel Prize if I could tell you what caused the onset of labour. But if the baby does initiate labour, we can presume that all those pre-labour physiological preparations are there, and that the outcomes will be better for mothers and babies. And that's looking at physiologic principles. As I said, nobody's done a study on that, but it would be a very interesting study to do. And, you know, I would guess almost certainly that the outcomes would be better for the mother and the baby. Although, actually, I just mentioned one study, which was a study of the outcome for the baby after after a cesarean, and they did compare babies with a pre-labour cesarean and babies with an in-labour cesarean, and the babies with an in-labour cesarean had better outcomes, like less chance of needing to go into neonatal intensive care, less chance of dying before hospital discharge. This is a very large South American study. So, you know, we'd have to guess that the physiology and what we know so far is pointing in the direction that, you know, a pre-labour cesarean that's actually physiologic onset of labour is ideal.
Yeah, it's interesting. I want to take a quick break and come back and talk about third stage, and also, you know, in those different scenarios. So we'll just take a quick break and come back and hear more wonderful, insightful things from you, Sarah.
Sure, my pleasure, Sarah.
This is the EWN Radio Network.
So we're here with Sarah Buckley, Dr. Sarah Buckley, talking about all wonderful things about birth and hormones. And I wanted to talk now about third stage, which is the delivery of the placenta, which I always thought should be called fourth stage because, you know, you have the baby on you, initiate third stage, and that's sort of referred to as fourth stage. But anyway, so third stage of labour is generally managed, isn't it, in most settings? So, you know, tell us about continuing on with the hormones, the importance of the hormones in labour and a safe delivery of the placenta.
Okay, well, that's a big topic. And again, I'd refer people back to my report. And by the way, some people don't like the numbers. We shouldn't use the numbers. And some people call it the placental stage, which I kind of like because I like placentas. So I call it the placental.
Yeah, me too.
What's happening in that time as far as the hormones go is that the hormones of labour and birth are reaching peak levels at the moment the mother pushes her baby out. But some of these hormones levels are even higher in that hour or so after birth. So particularly the mother's oxytocin, and we talked about oxytocin being a hormone that contracts the uterus, and that's ideal that her oxytocin levels peak after the birth because that's when she most needs good, strong contractions to stop her from bleeding. And what's actually happening inside her uterus is that the placenta has been stuck onto the side of her uterus, embedded in her uterus, and that's been transferring blood and nutrients between herself and her baby. But that placenta, as the uterus shrinks down after the baby comes out, it starts to peel off. So the fact's a bit like if you stuck a postage stamp on a balloon and then deflated the balloon, the stamp would peel off, right? So the placenta is peeling off there. But as it comes away, all those blood vessel interconnections are getting exposed. So there's a risk of bleeding, the risk of bleeding there. So what you need is nice, strong contractions to contract the mother's uterus up and seal up those placental blood vessels. So the mother's oxytocin levels after birth, that peak that naturally happens after birth, is actually saving her life. And they also benefit the baby because when we get these peak levels of oxytocin, it causes a flushing in our body. So for women, it causes a flushing on the chest, even up to the neck. It's a flushing that we can get with sexual arousal. Some of the listeners may recognize that. But it's actually designed to keep the baby warm again, because when we're out in the wild, there's no blankets, no heaters, no bunny rides, right? So the baby goes straight on the mother's chest, skin to skin. The mother's blood vessels on the chest wall open up or vasodilate, and that causes a natural warming mechanism for the baby. So those two things that oxytocin does is actually saving the mother's life and saving the baby's life. And the way that the mother gets these peaks of oxytocin after the birth, which can, by the way, according to studies, even be 10 times higher than what they were at that moment she pushed her baby out, is through her interactions with the baby. So being skin to skin and eye to eye releases oxytocin. But specifically, the first thing the baby does when they get onto the mother's body, the baby does this breast crawl. I hope some of the listeners have heard of this breast crawl, that the baby has this mechanism. They have a stepping reflex to help them to step up the mother's body. They have all these reflexes that help define the breast. So But when they find the breast, the first thing they do is they massage in the mother's nipple. It's a bit like the things that little kittens do, yeah? And that massaging the mother's nipple is what really increases the mother's oxytocin levels, even up to 10 times, which is then going to contract your uterus up nicely and cause that vasodilation that's going to keep her baby warm as well. The oxytocin levels are peaking. Beta endorphins, we talked about those as reward hormones, hormones of pleasure and transcendence, I call them. So those levels are peaking at the moment of birth. They have those, these hormones have those effects within the brain. We know that when we measure those hormones in the body, they do come down quite steeply after birth. But animal studies and also physiologic understandings tell us that these hormones probably have an ongoing, quite a high level in the brain. And that's what, according to what I put together, my model is that that's what switches on those reward centers in relation to contact with the baby. And then we have excitement hormones, adrenaline, noradrenaline. The baby's had this catecholamine surge, so the baby at birth is wide-eyed and alert. You've seen pictures of newborn babies. I had a baby yourself. You'll recognize this when a baby comes out from a physiologic birth. The baby's like wide-eyed, so wide-eyed you just can't help looking in their eyes. Are they really alert, yeah, for an hour or so, an hour or two after birth? And that's the catecholamine surge. So the baby's in this ideal situation to find the breast, to suckle. I mean, it's really, you know, the most important thing the baby we do in our life is to find the breast and attach. And when the baby does that, when the baby finds the breast themselves, the chance of breastfeeding difficulty is dramatically reduced. And babies have this capacity just like every other mammalian newborn does. And the fourth hormone, prolactin, also peaks in that hour after birth. In fact, for quite a few hours after birth. And again, this is a calming, relaxing, connecting hormone, again, switching on instinctive mothering behavior. So all of those hormones, that's why I call it an ecstatic hormonal cocktail, because that's exactly what's there to reward the mother, to connect it with her baby, to stop her bleeding, to save her life, I mean, and to initiate breastfeeding. It's what some of my work's been inspired and mentored by a doctor called Michel Odon, who's a Frenchman who was a surgeon originally, actually, but now he's a very powerful natural birth activist or advocate, you could say. And he says that this time after birth is the beginning of a great love affair. You know, and it's the basis of species survival, that the mother falls in love with the baby and will go on to do everything that she needs to do for the baby and be rewarded and motivated. And then the baby also attaches to the mother. And that's a great feeling. You can probably endorse that. It's an amazing, ecstatic feeling, but it's actually there to ensure species survival.
Yeah, that's right. I had with my fourth one, which I had at home, my neighbour came over with about 40 minutes after I had the baby, and she'd had intervention with her births, and she wrote me a letter afterwards because she was a very religious person, and she couldn't believe what she had experienced just coming into the room after, you know, an ecstatic birth. And she wrote me a letter saying, thanking us for letting her experience heaven on earth. And that was just her observing that mother-baby bond, which she hadn't experienced herself, because it's really impactful, isn't it? It really fills the whole room.
It really does. And I'll share something about that, Tara. So they've done studies on oxytocin specifically, and this may apply to the other hormones, and they've discovered that they actually have a pheromonal spread. So pheromones are hormones that are passed from one individual to another through the air, and we perceive them through this organ in our nose called the vomeronasal organ. So I did studies on rats, actually, and they put two rats in a cage, and they administered oxytocin to one of the rats, and they saw, yes, it did have those effects. But then they tested the cage mate, and the cage mate also had effects of oxytocin that was administered to another rat. And they figured out that it's actually transmitted pheromonally. And your story illustrates that perfectly. So when, you know, a woman's labored and birthed under her own steam, and she's got these huge peaks of oxytocin, 10 times higher than even at that moment of giving birth, which was high already, everyone in the room can get it. And it is, as you say, it's heaven on earth. It's a love fest. Everybody falls in love. The baby falls in love with the mother falls in love with the baby, the mother falls in love with the midwife, the father falls in love with the mother. I mean, it's just designed to be, to have everyone fall in love with each other. And I think, you know, not just for a good feeling, but I also wonder if that's there for what we call allo-parenting, to make sure that all those people in that room are going to fall in love with the baby, are going to look out for the baby, because that's going to contribute to the baby's survival when they're living in, you know, tribal groups and small communities as well.
That's right. And also to look after the mother, you know, for the community to come in and really look after the mother, especially in those first few weeks, which is another thing that we've lost a little bit. So many women feeling like they should get up and be out and about and doing things for themselves, when really that, you know, it's known as confinement period, that time of coming in and resting and everybody looking after the baby and the mother so that they can bond. I did ask my husband what would be his one bit of advice for new dads, and he said, just do everything so the mother and the baby can get to know each other. That if he was going to give one bit of advice to new dads, that was it.
That's a very wise papa. That's a very wise father. And look, I think you're right. I think we've lost that. I mean, in many traditional cultures, it's 40 days or about 6 weeks of confinement of the mother and baby being looked after so that they can bond with each other. And I think it is not the sensitive period where all these relationships are developing between mother and baby. And if there's one thing the mother needs, it's rest and tender, loving care. She's been through this extraordinary process, this huge opening, this huge, you know, hormonal peaks to have her birth of a baby. And, you know, I think we really need to be honouring of that space that mothers are in. Just from my own experience, I remember when I heard about that, I actually went, when I was training as in obstetrics, I went to a talk that it was actually, I think she was from the Netherlands, this local family doctor, GP, and she said, I tell all my mothers that they shouldn't take the baby out of the house for 6 weeks because the baby might get an infection. And I was sort of affronted by that. I was like, I didn't have children. I was sort of feminist. I thought, that's really, that's unfeminist. That's like, you know, that's telling women what to do. But after having babies myself, goodness me, I thought, that's so smart. That is so wise because, you know, you are very vulnerable and, you know, everything's just getting settling down and you're getting to know your baby and your baby's getting to know you. And I've come to the conclusion after four babies that the more I invest in that time after birth, the better my recovery is and the easier my whole first year is, to be honest. Like, you know, I went up to, from having like 2 weeks to having like, you know, a full 6 weeks. I didn't drive, I didn't go on a car, I didn't leave the house actually for 6 weeks after my fourth baby was born. It was so nourishing and really kept me going through that first year with four children.
Yeah, that's right. With our first one, I was, I was back in my jeans and taking the baby out, and we went to the markets, and all the Chinese and the Greek owners of all the, you know, the fruit and vegetable markets were all telling me off, telling me to go home.
Yeah.
Baby home. What are you doing? And I too did more and more confinement period, and I say to everyone, if I can do it with my sixth, you can do it with your first or second. Coming back to the pheromones is quite interesting, that with having those witnesses and being a part of feeling that oxytocin after the birth, then your friends and your closest friends or families are going to come in and, you know, they will look after you, you know, if you decide to really honour that time and that space and allow that bonding and transformation, that time of getting to know each other, you know, letting other people step up and help you. I think, you know, back on the feminist thing, that's a bit of a hard thing for us to do at the moment. I find that's a big challenge for a lot of women, letting other people step up and help you. But it's so needed.
Yeah, it's such an investment, isn't it? I want to say one more thing about that, which is that we have this idea that, you know, we should have guests around, people come around, they should hold the baby. And I want to say something sort of against that, really. I mean, you've got to follow your own instincts as a mother. But I think in that time, the primary thing that's happening is the relationship between the baby and the mother. And it's not just, you know, an idea that I have. It's also, we're talking about biology, because what's happening in that time is that the baby at birth is virtually sterile. That baby has no germs on them. Yeah, the baby gets colonized. All the baby's orifices, the baby's gut, the baby's nose, ears, you know, everywhere is getting colonized. The bacteria coming onto the baby from the mother. So I think the primary contact for the baby should be with the mother. Skin to skin with the mother is ideal to seed and colonize that baby with the bacteria from the mother that are friendly bacteria that belong in the environment. Yeah. So if other people hold that baby, and there is actually an interesting study on this. Now, they may be colonising the baby with their bacteria, which are not so friendly for the baby. And so from a hormonal perspective, it's about baby and mother getting entrained, getting regulated between each other with these hormones. And then from a microbiological perspective, it's about the baby getting colonised. So, I would say about, you know, be really cautious about letting anyone from outside your family have contact with your baby. You know, you're certainly, you know, anyone that's living in your household, they're going to have the same bacterial flora as well. But it's really, from my point of view, it's really mama-baby time at 6 weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a challenge for people, I know, with my clients of, you know, not looking like the overprotective new mother and actually, you know, saying to people beforehand sometimes is needed that, you know, not going to be passing the baby around. And I always say to the girls, it's a slow introduction to the world for the baby. And again, I watched my cat do this beautifully. It was amazing. She let them come out in the hallway and then she moved them in the middle of the night to my daughter's bedroom, the kittens. And then one morning, the kittens must have been about a week old, she brought one out into the living room and sat back and watched to see that it was all safe and okay. And then when she decided everything was okay, she brought the others out one at a time. So
wow.
It was a very slow introduction to the world. And I didn't let anyone touch the kittens until she brought them to us. So it was, I wish I videoed it actually, but it was really fascinating.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it was amazing to watch her slowly bring them out into the rest of the house and introduce them to the rest of the family. Yeah.
Beautiful.
So we thought,
just to say one more thing about that, I think that's better for the baby as well. Like the baby's neurological system is very, in a particular state, I could call it undeveloped, but it's not, their neurology doesn't function like an adult does. In fact, their nerves are not myelinated. So myelinated means that there's a covering on the nerves. It's a bit like, you know, electrical cords with a covering over them that makes the electricity travel faster. So newborn or babies' nerves are not myelinated. So think that their nerves, things move slowly, yeah? So they're very slow. Their perception or their sensory perception is slow. Their timing is slow. So, you know, when we just keep the baby with the mother or with the immediate family, then you can tune into that slowness of the baby. But people coming into the space aren't necessarily going to be aware of that and may or may not be able to even meet that baby in that slow space. So again, I think it's, you know, what you're describing with the kittens, it's much safer, better for the baby's introduction to the world as well, to have that confinement, that quiet time.
Yeah, that's right. And they have, you know, a lot of babies are overstimulated, aren't they? A lot of women have problems with their babies being unsettled, and often they're just overstimulated and you know, being passed around too much or just too much happening, everything not slowing down enough for the baby to cope with it easily.
And I think the core thing there, Tara, is really the mother's knowledge of the baby. So if mother and baby have that time together to get to know each other, you know, because every baby is different. Like my first baby was such an extrovert. Like I took her to a Thanksgiving party when she was 3 weeks old and she got passed around. I mean, I wouldn't do that again now, but she was fine. Like she loved that. She, you know, interacted with everybody, and even now she's a very extrovert young woman. And my fourth baby, like, didn't want any of that. She would even cry when her grandmother held her, which was quite tricky. And she, like, when I went out, I put several layers over her, you know, had her in a front pack with lots of layers over. She was a different baby. But, you know, I knew that as a mother instinctively, even though I probably maybe couldn't have said it at the time. And I think, you know, if mothers get that time with their baby to know their baby and to tune into their baby, then they'll know what the right thing is for that baby and what is overstimulation and what's not overstimulation. And just another thing to say, we live in a very overstimulated culture, don't we? We're very go, 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 yang, yang, yang. And babies are sensitive to that and they pick up the vibe around them. So, you know, if you want to reduce the stimulation for your baby, you might actually have to do it for yourself as well.
Yeah, that's right. We are all on the go all the time, and that's a challenge in itself for women to slow down in pregnancy, slow down to come into labour, and then, you know, slow down and just allow themselves to be with the baby. And, you know, that's where baby carrying and things like that come in to really helping connect with the baby and keep that skin to skin and the oxytocin going and co-sleeping, being close to the baby and getting to know the baby.
That's exactly right, that you're an experienced mother talking there, Tara, because all of those things do release hormones. They release prolactin and oxytocin and beta endorphins. They're all calming hormones. So even in pregnancy, we're releasing those hormones. So Mother Nature's trying to get us into this slow down, take it easy, chill out frame. And, you know, if we can put aside what needs to be put aside to allow ourselves to get into that frame, it's very beneficial. We can really, you know, get the most out of our hormones and feel better too and enjoy it, you know. You know, anything that you can do to calm yourself down, like yoga, like meditation, just walking, as simple as walking, or putting your feet up and lying down and putting your hands on your belly, all of those things are very beneficial in pregnancy to get these hormones going and the connection with your baby and the slowing down.
Yeah, that's right. And they're simple and cost effective. You know, they're you know, something that everyone has access to, you know, going for a walk. You know, it can be simple, the things that you know, you can do to help come into that space. I just want to finish off with, you've got your article, Healing Birth, Heal the Earth, and a little bit about, you know, reclaiming rites of passage. And, you know, tell us a little bit about that article that you've written, Healing Birth, Heal the Earth.
Well, I think that the meaning of birth is much wider than just the mother pushing the baby out. Like, it has a whole lot of meanings in our culture, and it really is essentially the most powerful act that we can do as a woman, and probably the most powerful act that there is, to make a baby, to gestate a baby, to push a baby out. And I don't see in our culture that we really acknowledge that and we really respect that. And it, you know, there's parallels between the way that disrespect that we have, even for ourselves in that process. It can be hard, exactly as you're saying, to honour and respect this incredible transition we're going through, and to put aside, you know, some of the things that we might do in our ordinary life that are not in alignment with that, that speed us up, that stress us, yeah? So pregnancy is a time to honour and acknowledge this incredible, sometimes I call it full-time job of gestating a baby, you know? And just from a, you know, scientific point of view, we know that, you know, it's really important to reduce your stress in pregnancy, because the baby can have impacts on the baby. So, you know, honouring pregnancy, honouring labour and birth, and that incredible process that we go through. And, you know, I think we've done a really nice job of talking about ways to honour that, and particularly that ritual of the time after the birth, and honouring the birthing mother as, like, God, you know, done something incredible. I mean, for my mind, it's better than climbing Mount Everest, because you have a baby as well. When I had my last baby,
right,
I honestly felt like I'd won the lotto twice. And, oh my God, I've had this incredible experience, and I've got the baby. Like, I just, it was, it completely blew me away. So, you know, honouring those processes, which is also honouring the hormones, and, you know, honouring ourselves as mothers, and that our bodies can provide everything that our babies need. It's incredible that we've got the warmth, we've got the nutrition. I mean, our body is all that our baby needs. In essence, we can get all these crates and crates of baby stuff, but the most important thing is our body and our willingness to be there and to be present and to have our babies with us. So really honouring all of those processes, and then in that essay I also make parallels between that and the way that we honour the earth. So I really believe that reclaiming the feminine power of birth helps us to reclaim the care of the earth as well.
Yeah, it's so true. We could talk for hours, Sarah.
So
we better finish off. So just quickly tell us, so your website is sarahbuckley.com, and you've got a new program coming out. You want to quickly tell us about that before we finish off?
Yeah, so I've got a website called gentlenaturalbirth.com, and there's a membership program in there. So if you're pregnant, you can sign up. We're doing the early pregnancy, and pretty soon we'll be releasing the mid-pregnancy and the late-pregnancy programs. So you'll get a slice of my science and wisdom, some of the hormone things we've talked about, but a lot of different topics. And really with this emphasis on how can we make the most of the experiences, and how can we optimise ease, pleasure and safety. So I talk about choosing your care providers. I talk about pregnancy nausea. I talk about what's happening in your body. I talk about pregnancy diet, some of those very basic things in these programs as well. So gentlenaturalbirth.com, and we do have programs for birth professionals there as well. So check that out, and you can go to my website, sarahbuckley.com. I really recommend, as I mentioned before, that you go there and sign up to my e-newsletters, because you'll get these fantastic e-books. You'll get Ecstatic Birth Nature's Promoted Blueprint for Labour, which talks about the hormones in a lot of detail, more than we've said today. I actually wrote that article for Mothering Magazine back in 2002. And then there's an article called Pain and Labour, Your Hormones Are Your Helpers, which very appropriately has a cat story in it, which is very similar to your cat story,
yeah.
Sarah. So you can sign up for one or both of those and get that information.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, we had quite fun with the cat being pregnant, because she had her 5 kittens 3 days after I had my 5th baby.
Wow.
But her nesting, she wanted to birth in my room, you see, and I was like, well, no, I'm birthing in here. You have to birth somewhere else. So my mum and I spent weeks rubbing towels on her and putting them into different corners of the house so that she would choose happily choose somewhere else to birth because she really wanted to nest under my bed, and I thought, oh, maybe that's not the right thing.
Yeah,
so she did choose one of our spots, which was the hallway cupboard in the end. So, yeah, it was fascinating. Anyway, thank you so much for your time. And we will no doubt speak to you again. And, yeah, so it's sarahbuckley.com. And, well, what was the other one? Gentle Natural Birth.
GentleNaturalBirth.com, yeah. Thanks, Tara. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, great. Thanks, Sarah.
This is the EWN Radio Network.